other moving targets. Let On the Media be your guide.
Saturday afternoon at 4.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Yes, I'm back. Big thanks to Patricia Rabaio and Genevieve Hardnett for filling in for me while I was out. And thanks as well to the super dedicated listeners who noticed that I said I wouldn't be in last Wednesday, but then I was in on Wednesday, and I left for real on Thursday. I can't pull anything over on you folks. That's why you're dedicated listeners. You're sharp. Anyway, thank you so much for being here with me. We've got news to get to. Coming up, we learn what's behind New York State lawmakers' push to end anonymous reporting of child abuse. Experts say about 95% of reported cases are unfounded. Radio Catskill's Annie Bennett talks to Nila Natarajan, Associate Director of Policy and Family Defense at Brooklyn Defender Services. It's coming up in the second half of the program. But first, from vaccines to Tylenol, myths about autism and medication seem to resurface every few years. And recently, President Trump held a news conference that reignited these claims. Decades of scientific research have shown no link between autism and medicine, but misinformation persists, and it hurts the abilities of families to make informed choices. It also detracts from the needs that people on the spectrum actually have. To help cut through the noise, Radio Catskill's Patricio Rabaio spoke with Dr. Noor Sayed and Lauren Lumo Allen, both from SUNY Empire State University and its Center for Autism Advocacy, Research, Education, and Support, better known as CARES. He talked about the facts, the myths, and the importance of accurate education. Here's Dr. Sayed, starting off with what CARES is all about.
So CARES is really a set of initiatives that are driven by the mission and vision to help communities become as inclusive as possible through universal design. So historically, for example, in higher education institutions, there's been an emphasis on autistic and neurodiverse students having to change to meet the societal and cultural expectations. And instead at CARES, we really support having the environment adapt to be as supportive and as inclusive for as many individuals as possible, with the goal that they don't have to disclose, they don't have to pay extra for services and so on. So our primary mission right now is to support Empire State University in being that autistic and neurodiverse supportive environment through universal design. But our vision is to help create these inclusive environments throughout the community. And so that's really a strong part of what we do.
So let's talk what's in the news now. President Trump recently made comments linking Tylenol use during pregnancy to autism. You know, these conversations are nothing new, and these things have been happening from time to time. You know, especially during like the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about, you know, vaccines or autism, and that came to head. And now we have this, what President Trump said. I just want to know, why do you think stories like this or claims like this keep resurfacing?
You know, historically, there was an article that was published years ago in a scientific journal that reported to link vaccines like the MMR vaccine with autism. And that was shared by a celebrity and a platform, and it started to gain speed. But the reality is that study was retracted, and the doctor who did publish that study stated that the findings were falsified. So what we're seeing is that sometimes like these one or two investigations can be taken out of context, and they can be taken as this is exactly what's happening, when in reality, that's not always the case. What we really want to look for now, and I think what's highly relevant to the conversation that is occurring in terms of Tylenol and autism, is that these studies can be taken out of context, and they can be taken where as if one study is sort of exactly what we need to follow. But in reality, what we need to do is really look deeply at those studies to investigate the rigor of them. And also, I think hugely important is to look at the wealth of information that exists. And the information that exists to date really strongly suggests that Tylenol is not at this time, to the best of our knowledge, strongly linked to autism. There might be one or two studies that have investigated that, but since there's been a preponderance of research that has not supported that Tylenol or acetaminophen is linked to autism. So I would really say it's so important to help empower our community to understand that these studies might occur, but they really need to be taken, again, into context and with the reality of the wealth of scientific information that has been published and has been rigorously studied that does not show that causation between acetaminophen and Tylenol the way it did not show a causation between MMR vaccines and autism.
You know, when this news broke out, I did some research on the study that President Trump was sort of referring to. And from what I heard in other news reports that these types of studies weren't that scientific, they were more like, you know, asking patients, pregnant women at that time, you know, did you take Tylenol? And some said yes. And some, you know, had to recall whether they took it or not. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about exactly the study or the types of study that President Trump was referring to.
And I think, first, I think that it is incredibly important to honor and hear lived experiences of individuals. So, you know, pregnant women, autistic communities, to understand what those experiences are. But exactly as you're describing, I think it really needs to be taken into context. And that can give one part of the story at one snapshot in time. And so what I think would be incredibly important to do and what our studies have not done yet is to really empirically and rigorously evaluate if there is any linkage between use of Tylenol or acetaminophen and autism. And the reality is that we just don't have enough data at this time, enough really scientific data. What, you know, research has strongly supported is rigorous and peer-reviewed to say that there is a link. So absolutely honor and hearing those voices of and the lived experiences of those who are part of those investigations. But again, just wanted to acknowledge that there is a plethora of other data that we've not yet unearthed or investigated that has indicated that. So I think it's really, again, you know, the risk of sounding kind of really important to empower the community, to families, to give them that knowledge, because a strong concern is that if we give part of the information, that people can make decisions that will be dangerous for themselves and for others in the longer term, because they're only hearing one study or one part of a study rather than the massive amounts of data that we have investigated and continue to research. And Lauren, please feel free to jump in as well.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'll just add the studies that I think the primary study that was cited was a review. And so it wasn't original research. It was reviewing other research. And within that, they found some studies that supported some association. And I'll talk more about what that means, as well as some that found no association and so forth. Right. So a lot of variability there. And I think the point about evidence is just really important. Right. We never want to look at like one study. Like Nora said, we want to look at the preponderance of that information. So evidence is made up of extensive, high quality studies that start to form give us consensus about a given scientific question. Right. And again, Nora and I are not medical doctors, but we're just kind of sharing what has been put out by the professional organizations that are trustworthy. Right. So the American ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, continues to affirm the safety and the benefits of acetaminophen during pregnancy, right? Noting that extreme harm would occur if pregnant women don't take acetaminophen when they have high fever during pregnancy, right? So that is the most important message. Putting out information at a press conference that indicates that there were made very strong claims about its lack of safety was truly just unfounded and really could cause harm. So the biggest message that we would like to reiterate is for folks to listen to their medical doctors, talk with their OBGYNs, their medical providers, ask questions if they have them, but to understand that trustworthy professional organizations that represent those who have medical expertise, such as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, continues to highlight how critical it is for pregnant women to take acetaminophen during pregnancy.
I want to see if you could talk a little bit about the misinformation and how it affects families. When my daughter was going to be born, you know, I have to be honest and truthful that, you know, I was concerned about vaccines and, this is my personal experience, my personal beliefs. You know, I believe in science and all that. And I believe the doctors and the health experts. But it creeped in there, the seed of doubt that, maybe they're right. Does it cause autism or the birth defects? And that could be troubling because it's such an important milestone and life event that's going to happen. And you want things to go right. You want, you know, not to harm the baby and things like that. You know, how does this misinformation affect families with children on the spectrum or not on the spectrum?
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing about your family as well. I'm going to say that it can be really dangerous to have misinformation and to have information shared that isn't fully vetted, again, without that context. You know, I'm going to share that this is something that's affected my family personally. I have loved ones or had loved ones with really significant support needs, intellectual, physical, developmental disabilities. And my family was given information that was incomplete and inaccurate, and it changed the course of our lives forever. And that is something that, you know, that occurred 20 years ago now, or a little bit more. And we have to be so careful to not be in the same place, because we have since that time had learned so much more about how to empower our families, how to empower the autistic community, how to make sure we're listening to lived experiences, engaging in really strong socially valid practices, that we don't go back there. And if we continue to give misinformation publicly, I fear that we're going to end up in that place again where families are being forced to make decisions that are already incredibly difficult without having accurate information. And as Lauren mentioned, there are these, you know, incredibly important and reputable areas such as ACOG, who is talking about the importance of protecting folks through the use of acetaminophen, and that is not currently linked to autism. So it can be really dangerous. And we've seen that our families have reported that. We at CARES have experienced that. We need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to give accurate, unbiased scientific information that takes into account all of the data, not just one piece of it.
And, you know, with that misinformation that's going on, you know, what can schools and healthcare providers, even us, the media, can do to help prevent and or not prevent, but to help improve the public understanding of what is really factual and accurate and helpful?
Yeah, I think it's so important to just contribute to messaging that values autistic people and autistic people as a part of just human diversity, highlighting the importance of valuing science and autistic lived experience and their expertise in their lived experience, and really contributes to a culture where skepticism certainly is healthy, but that it also co-occurs really with efforts to seek out a variety of trustworthy and reliable sources to be an informed consumer. We're in a different time. Social media and all the different sources people have to go to information, podcasts, and all those sorts of things has really changed the way that we can all access information, and they can present varying levels of reliability, right, and trustworthiness compared to before those days when you had a few different news sources and they were largely presenting more trustworthy information. So we have to be incredibly cautious of where we're consuming information from and going to places that, we're ensuring that we're presenting messaging that encourages people to talk to their doctors, to their medical providers, talk to those who have expertise on the topic, and advocate for the questions or concerns that they have. And if you're not being validated and you're not being heard, talk to another, you know, medical provider or somebody else with that expertise, so that you can get your questions answered in a way that will allow you to make really informed choices for your child, for yourself, and so forth.
For parents who are right now feeling overwhelmed by conflicting information, what advice or resources would you recommend parents go to for well-informed information?
Yeah, I think it's just really important to acknowledge that, especially in the context of autistic individuals, blaming mothers has been done before, and that has really caused great harm, right? Autistic people, again, should be celebrated and valued, and nobody should be blamed for causing, again, just this neurological difference, right? These strong claims that were not supported by scientific data likely have had the effect already of scaring parents, scaring caregivers away from safe medicines, safe vaccines, And ultimately, that fear will lead to potential, you know, harm for pregnant mothers, for fetuses, and for individuals, as well as really contributing to greater levels of stigma for autistic people, right? I think these conversations are really creating the messaging that autistic people are not, that they need to be, something needs to be fixed with them, something is wrong, and that couldn't be farther from the truth, right? Instead, we want to, you know, really ensure that autistic people are, and autistic and families of autistic people are given access to the resources that contribute to their inclusivity and their quality of life and that they value, right? So getting information that's helpful, again, talking to individuals that you trust is one piece of it. And the second part is that have some expertise in the conversation. So whether that's professional education and training or, and again, lived experience, we want to value those perspectives of autistic individuals and their families. We really want to also, you know, encourage people to go to reliable, if they're looking online, looking at things that come from professional organizations that represent, you know, health providers, right? So again, American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists related to these topics, right? You can think about the trustworthiness of information if it has, you know, .org or .edu after in the URL, right? That's going to increase the likelihood that it's coming from a more reputable organization. I think those are really two points. And again, I know we've said it, it can't be said enough. Going directly to the people, you know, your OBGYN, your doctor, your child's doctor, and advocating and ensuring that you are heard and that your experiences are validated is really important.
Lauren, if you could clear up one big misunderstanding about autism right now, what would it be?
That's a great question. And there's a lot of room for that right now. And it's really important to clear up some of these. So I'm going to try to do it succinctly. But firstly, just autistic people should be celebrated. Autism is not an epidemic. The connotation of using that language is really harmful for autistic people and families of autistic people. Autistic people don't need to be cured. Instead, you know, autistic people, like other people, you know, just deserve the supports and services that benefit them and that they value. And research that supports these efforts is welcomed by them. It's also important to just understand that autistic individuals and their families are not a monolith, right? They're not all the same. Autistic people have varied strengths, preferences, values, challenges. And so because of that, the supports and services that they want and would benefit from is going to vary. The priorities and perspectives of autistic people and their families have to be centered in conversations regarding research priorities, services, and supports. And again, just kind of going back to that note of, you know, autistic people just need to be understood as a valuable part of that human diversity that exists. And although, you know, there are fewer autistic people in society than non-autistic people, it doesn't mean that the autistic way of being or communicating or experiencing the world should be considered a deficit, right? We want to consider it a difference, right? That contributes meaningfully to our human diversity.
You know, where can folks get more information, learn more about CARES and the work you do, and get resources and information that you can provide?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, I'd say the first place that's probably the easiest is just shoot us an email. We provide a lot of consultation to individuals and families. We provide a lot of education and training to the community. We support with inclusive programming and those sorts of things. Send us an email at autism@sunniempire.edu. And we can also share our website with you as well.
Before we go, is there anything else we have not discussed that you want folks to know about?
As we consider kind of the research that was discussed and has been referenced as a result of the press conference, what's really important to understand is that you can't do randomized control trials on pregnant women. It's not ethical. And therefore, the research that's being done tends to be observational in nature, which doesn't allow us to understand cause and effect relationships, right? So at best, we end up with understanding kind of correlational information or associations. And what you think about sometimes is what's been noted is in hotter months, right, in the summer, there's a correlation or an association between ice cream sales and violent crimes, right? that's not a causal relationship, right? Ice cream doesn't cause an increase in violent crimes. Instead, heat is something that causally contributes to both of those occurring. So we want to ensure we're distinguishing between correlation and causation, and also understand that the studies rely heavily on self-report, right? And although that's valuable, there are certain limitations you have to consider, right? So the studies largely don't have, you know, they're not able to control for confounding factors or variables. And those are going to be other aspects in, you know, related to that individual, their environment, that may contribute to the outcomes, right? As well as just the, you know, sometimes unreliability of self-report data. And those things just have to be taken into consideration. And that's why we can't ignore the evidence, right? All the wealth of studies that really do point and create confidence and trust in those statements and the messaging that pregnant women should absolutely continue to take acetaminophen under consultation from their doctor in when they have high fevers and for pain relief during pregnancy.
I'm glad you said that, because hearing the report yesterday and one of the reporters and experts were saying that the having, let's say, for example, if a pregnant woman has fever, not taking Tylenol, not getting something to combat the fever could be even more dangerous to the mother and for the baby.
You're absolutely right. And that's why messaging, you know, that suggests pregnant women should not take acetaminophen is incredibly harmful and dangerous, right? For the fetus, for the pregnant mother. And so we, again, have to go back to those trustworthy sources of information.
We were talking to Dr. Noor Saeed and Lauren Allen from the Center for Autism Advocacy Research and Education and Supports at SUNY Empire State University. Thank you for joining us today and the time you took to help us break down the facts. Thank you to you both.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio, for that report. You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local. It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. For years, there's been a movement to forbid anonymous reports of child abuse in New York State. Proponents say the data shows a majority of these calls, a vast majority, are unsubstantiated, and they can be traumatizing for families. Critics say it would discourage people from coming forward with suspicions. Governor Hochul has until the end of the year to decide whether or not to sign the bill, which has already passed through the State House and Senate. Radio Catskill reporter Annie Bennett spoke with Nila Natarajan, Associate Director of Policy and Family Defense at Brooklyn Defender Services.
This piece of legislation, what we refer to as anti-harassment in reporting, came from families and parents who have been impacted by harassing and false or malicious anonymous reports.
And so it's successfully passed through the House and the Senate and is now waiting to be signed by the governor. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is the governor expected to sign it into law?
Quite frankly, we don't know. Unfortunately, with this particular governor, it has become quite common for her to veto legislation that has been passed with super majorities from her own party in the state and assembly. We are working to communicate with the governor's office and have not received any sort of definitive position. We are hopeful that she signs the bill into law.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Every family we work with has an experienced ACS investigation. We know those investigations are incredibly harmful and traumatic for most families. Our clients tell us there are agents of the state, these caseworkers who are coming to their home unannounced, day or night, sometimes in the middle of the night, with no warrant, with no paperwork saying they have to come into the home. They have to search your cabinets, under your bed, your closets. They're going to ask your children to take their clothes off and take photos of them without their clothes on.
Wait, I'm sorry. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So the families we work with report is that it is common to the point of routine that as part of this investigative process, the caseworker will ask parents to take their children's clothes off, what might be referred to as a strip search, and then take photos of their bodies. And, you know, ostensibly, they're looking for any sort of marks or bruises, indications of any sort of corporal punishment. Now, our experience, again, working with families is that workers will make this request to families regardless of what the allegations or the safety concerns are that were reported in the report. And we've kind of been told, you know, that's not the case. That's not our policy. We don't do that. And yet the families we're working with are reporting that over and over again. And I'm hesitating when I'm calling it an ask of the caseworker, because what the families we work with report is, it doesn't feel like an ask.
For sure.
It feels like a demand, or it feels like an ask with a threat behind it.
It seems to me that there would be obvious pros, though, to allowing anonymous child abuse reporting, encourage more people to come forward, make it easier to protect children.
Over 95% of anonymous reports after investigation are ultimately found to have insufficient evidence. There's no evidence of child maltreatment. And we've been told by families that an investigation will last up to 60 days and the caseworker will make these home visits, quote unquote, many times, certainly more than once. It's really a very invasive and kind of threatening process. It becomes apparent when a family is experiencing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sometimes tens, dozens reports with similar allegations over and over again, or allegations that kind of have nothing to do with the facts of the family. Like, so kind of outlandishly false that it's really hard to conclude anything other than it's a harassing call.
I guess if the main issue is these repeated unsubstantiated reports, why come after the anonymity as the solution?
Yes, there's the possibility that someone makes a good faith report and ultimately there's no evidence that's found. If we know more than 95% of these anonymous reports lead to no finding of child maltreatment, and we know these investigations are invasive, and we know that it's quite a low standard of evidence, I don't think there are really clear upsides. If that high of a percentage of these tens of thousands of calls lead to no finding, then that traumatic experience of an investigation is a harm in and of itself. So it's definitely an incremental step towards addressing this harm, and it's a necessary step. And we do think it will have a significant impact.
So what kind of opposition have you been facing?
I think there are fears around someone being deterred to make a call. I think the reality is, because right now we have people who are mandated to make the reports as a professional, and they're required to leave their information. And then you have people who are not mandated reporters, and they do leave their information. And those folks' information is to be kept confidential as is. And that particular situation and beyond has obligations around confidentiality. And so if we're relying on the system to accept these reports and to investigate and to collect really sensitive information, then we can also ensure that those folks who want to make a good faith report can be assured that they can do so and it can be kept confidential. There's been some pushback with a concern about young people who may want to make an anonymous report. And the one thing I'll say there is, in my decade plus experience in working with families in the system, I have never once seen a child themselves make a report. When people have pushed back, it's just very clear to me that people are looking at this legislation without deep experience in the system and are looking at it in isolation and having a very impulse emotional response to not wanting to make change in the system. And the thing about this piece of legislation, as we talked about, it's a move towards reducing the harm of the system. It's not a wholesale solution. It's easy to succumb to the kind of fear-based narratives that are really rooted in quite a racist history.
What do you mean by that specifically?
The reality is that the entirety of the system, from the mandates to report and the investment in reporting as a response to a family in need of resources, to investigation and prosecution and family separation of the state coming in as a policing body and investigating and then prosecuting and then taking a child out of their home and putting them in the care of the state. That system is rooted in decades, if not centuries, of our society and our legal culture using family separation as a tool of racialized violence.
What are the specific next steps that this faces vis-a-vis Governor Hochul?
So she can call up the piece of legislation. And if she officially does that, she has 30 days to either veto the legislation or sign it into law. Or she can do nothing. Then the bill does not become law. And all of this, I believe, must occur by December 31st. And it can still be amended.
All right. Well, we will keep our ears to the ground to see what happens. In Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Annie Bennett, for that report. I'm Jason Dole. That's it for the local edition. I'll be back tomorrow night. We'll talk to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. For now, stay with us for more news from the Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio.